And so we are continuing our study in 1 Corinthians. We're nearing the end. Chapter 15, verses 29 through 34. This is the center of essay number 5, where Paul speaks, where Paul writes on the ethics that arise out of the resurrection.
If then...
Ethics.
What does ethics mean? Ethics is how you treat one another.
Ethical, you know.
The rhetoric of this is a 5-section ring composition followed by an aside of a couple verses. It consists of ad hominem, personal attack argumentation, where Paul exposes the absurdity of the Corinthian position in terms of ethics. In other words, Paul describes what the real world results would be if the Corinthian position that there is no bodily resurrection is in fact true. The problem with this passage is that the literal text can be rather confounding. So it begins, otherwise, what do people mean by being baptized on behalf of the dead? If the dead were not raised at all, why are people being baptized on their behalf? Why are we in danger every hour? I protest, brothers, by my pride in you, which I have in Christ Jesus our Lord. I die every day. What do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with beasts at Ephesus? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. Wake up from your drunken stupor, as is right, and do not go on sinning, for some have no knowledge of God. I say this to your shame.
It sounds like Ecclesiastes or Proverbs.
So the first section, otherwise...
6 is a big mouthful.
Otherwise, what do people mean by being baptized on behalf of the dead? Now, that's one of the most confusing and least understood texts in the history of Christendom. Now, baptized on behalf of the dead or baptized for the dead? What exactly does it mean?
Well, he's not saying that we should be baptized. He's just saying, why are you if there's no point in if the dead aren't raised?
Well, some groups, for example, the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, literally do get baptized for the benefit of those that have died. Now, depending on which commentary, you know, there may be a couple dozen to upwards of 200 possible interpretations of this text that have been given.
200 interpretations. Okay.
So no one knows for certain exactly what was happening in the Corinthian church.
Didn't even know what he meant.
What's curious is that Paul never condemns the practice, whatever it was. So a few of the more viable interpretations include the dead is a metaphor for the body that is buried in the waters of baptism. So understood, a translation might read, otherwise, if there is not a future resurrection, what will those being baptized accomplish for the corpses? If corpses are not raised at all, why are they being baptized for them? Here, in agreement with the Greek fathers, corpses refer to the bodies of the people being baptized.
The actual body.
The actual
body.
Yourself. The physical body. You.
Yourself. Not someone else.
If in baptism one's body is immersed in water, dying and being buried with Christ, in hope of being united with Christ in a resurrection like his, if there is no future resurrection, then what is the point of the baptismal liturgy? The common Christian experience of baptism demands belief in a future resurrection.
Right. It's a symbol, and if the reality doesn't exist, then the symbol doesn't exist.
So that's one possible interpretation. Another one, the second one is converts were being baptized in a desire to be reunited with their now deceased Christian relatives.
And they couldn't be...
Baptism for the sake of the dead refers to the decision of a person or persons to ask for and to receive baptism as a result of the desire to be united with their believing relatives who have died.
I don't vote for that one.
I don't think your vote matters.
Good
we don't get to choose.
Those are the two that seem most in line with what Paul...
Well, the first one actually makes sense in that baptism is meaningless if there is no resurrection, because that's what baptism is representing.
Is death and resurrection of the body.
But the second also makes sense, because if there is no resurrection, then why are people becoming Christians and being baptized in order to be reunited? Whatever it was not a theological or practical problem for Paul. So, as much as we are curious about it, we shouldn't get too hung up over not understanding the details.
Oh, I understand it, so there's no need to get hung up.
The point is that baptism is a reenactment of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection that looks forward to a future bodily resurrection of believers. If a person doesn't believe there is a bodily resurrection, what is the point of being baptized? In effect, why be a Christian at all?
It can be a demon.
No.
Then we look at the part 5. If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die.
I don't have to do all this bad stuff anymore.
It follows section 1. If there is no resurrection, there is no Christianity. So let us drink, eat and drink, for tomorrow we die, is a sentiment of despair. There is nothing worthwhile in this world to live for, so drown your despairs as best you can, because you'll be dead anyway. It's not a statement saying that the world is more fun. So this follows the earlier two parts of the essay, the theology that without the resurrection, sin and death have won. There is no hope. There is no good.
Sin is right.
So if everything is going to end up in death,
Do whatever you feel good.
Drown your sorrows. Drown your despair, because that's all you've got.
And you're going to have more despair because you don't have hope. When hope isn't, you don't have any hope.
So you should probably look into being a hopeless alcoholic.
The middle section, Paul shifts from general ethics to personal experiences. Here, one must remember throughout that to deny the resurrection of the dead meant to deny the resurrection of Christ, which meant for Paul the denial of Christian life altogether. Thus, everything Christians do as Christians, and especially the labors of an apostle, are an absurdity if there is no resurrection. Paul writes this letter, 1 Corinthians, from Ephesus. It's probably shortly after this time where this letter is being written that a riot erupts in Ephesus regarding the silversmiths of Artemis. That's found in Acts chapter 19. Talking about another god which is greater than Artemis in a city where Artemis is greatly venerated, where the economy is based around her worship, is not a safe course of action.
It's like saying baseball, apple pie, and whatever is bad in America.
Politicians usually don't do that.
The beasts that Paul mentions, they are not literal beasts. Fighting beasts is not what Paul did in Ephesus. They are metaphorical language pointing to those who oppose Paul. I die every day. That phrase should be understood in the sense, on a daily basis, I face the reality of death. It is not language of literal daily self-sacrifice, but a symbolic one. And Paul uses the language of an oath to communicate the seriousness of his message.
You can shear your sheep lots of times, but you can only skin once. If you sacrifice yourself every day, only once it'll happen. It'll be over.
So without the resurrection, then Paul's efforts are merely human. It is simply a battle of one human philosophy over all the others. And what really is the point of that? Thus, without the resurrection, his earthly struggle is without meaning. He has gained nothing, but only now, but in the life to come. And not only for himself, but all for all those who have come to Christ. as a result of that struggle. What Paul is saying here in the middle is, if what you say is true, let's suppose that it's true, then why am I putting myself through all this? Because there's no point in it.
There's no point in life at all. Really.
But I protest. And he's swearing an oath. Brothers, by my pride in you, which I have in Christ Jesus our Lord, I die every day. You know, I'm doing this because I do believe in the actual bodily resurrection. It's the one thing that makes a difference. And we'll get to the aside, the very last. Yeah.
I have a little problem with that perspective. You said that if God created man with freedom of choice, then sin was inevitable. Hope doesn't exist because I believe it. I believe it because hope exists. Hope could not exist if there wasn't a resurrection.
No.
You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So, Paul's not being nice because of the resurrection. Paul couldn't be nice if there wasn't a resurrection. And therefore, the fact that he's nice proves there was a resurrection. Yes, it's. Am I just saying that, going around circles?
Maybe.
If God wasn't raised, then my being nice is for naught. I don't like to say that. If God wasn't raised, I couldn't be nice. That's kind of it.
I think no, it's both true.
Yeah, but it's true.
I guess.
But it couldn't exist at all. If sin was true, then the happiness that I can achieve could not exist.
It could exist, but it would be all for nothing.
It would be superficial. There'd be
if
no...
there was no resurrection, would you rather be Mordecai or Haman? I'd rather be Mordecai. Even if there wasn't a resurrection. But the point is, since there was a resurrection, if there wasn't a resurrection, Mordecai's philosophy couldn't exist. I'm not saying that emphatically. I'm trying to say I'm wrestling with that's the way I believe it. I don't know how to say it or how to.
Some people replace the resurrection with posterity, living through your children.
That's true. Put a lot of fancy things on your gravestone so people will remember you after you're gone.
For the early Hebrews, there was no resurrection.
For the night?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, they were nice in the sense that they looked out for the collective interests of their family group. And their goal, their purpose in life was to perpetuate life through offspring.
But I think what my premise is, if sin was right, the resurrection did not occur, I don't think mankind can be nice. I don't think we would have, by this time of Earth's history, we wouldn't even see a glimmer of it.
So they may not have believed in it, but that didn't mean it didn't affect them.
Yes. So what I'm saying is the fact that I see niceness out there proves to me that God is right. That's what I think I'm trying to say.
Okay. Yeah. Not saying it's wrong.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting that you're using the word nice, because the older meaning of the word nice, I did a word study on that word once, and the older meaning is actually more like conniving.
Okay.
Nice.
What a nice man.
Appearing nice to someone for the purpose
alternative
of
reasons,
something out of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the reason I use this because we always think that the people that go to heaven are those who keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus and are good people in regards to doctrines and beliefs and go to church and all that. And it has nothing
that's
to do with
not
that.
What we
it's
believe.
Being just being plain old nice.
Not conniving.
Not conniving, yeah.
Yeah, if the resurrection were
kind
there, then it'd be kind of the same thing, but with the other meaning.
Yeah. There's a lot of people out there very religious, but
you know, Jewish people have how do I say this? A lot of people think of Jewish people as being conniving.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a common, you know.
Well, we live in one Adventist ghetto, and the general public, non-Adventists, pretty much had the Adventists as pegged as being very conniving. Yeah. It was a bad.
Adventists don't have a corner on that market, though.
Yes.
Other people.
Oh.
It's a mindset.
That's not a... Yeah, that's not... Nothing to do with your church you belong to.
Right. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes. I'm not sorry.
So this last couple verses, it's a section of exhortation and correction. Paul quotes from Menander's Tithes. And so in this set of passages, Paul once again weaves in both Hebrew and Greek traditions to develop this point. He's speaking to both. Paul expressing his disapproval of becoming involved in discussions with those who dismiss the bodily resurrection. That's essentially what he's saying. He says, bad company ruins good morals. Wake up from drunken stupor. Paul's comparing it to drunken stupor. Paul's commanding them to wake from the stupor and realize what is happening to them, to halt their present course. It's not entirely clear precisely as to what "do not go on sinning" refers. It can be the denial of the resurrection and or any of the problems that were mentioned earlier in this letter, which, you know, there's a whole host of things that were mentioned. And it's also not clear what is intended by "for some have no knowledge of God." In relation to "I say this to your shame," it probably means it's probably some kind of put-down to shame those who claim special spiritual knowledge and who are leading the Corinthian church in its present disastrous course.
Don't be influenced by idiots.
Well, probably because most people have had such a difficult time knowing what to do with verse 29, there has been a strange silence in the church with regard to this paragraph. Yet it stands as one of the more significant texts pointing to a genuine relationship between what one believes about the future and how one behaves in the present. This is not to say that the future is the only motivation for correct behavior, but it is to plead that it is a proper one because it ultimately has to do with the nature and character of God. We should be living in this world as those whose confidence in the final vindication of Christ through our own resurrection determines the present. So how do we apply this ancient historical exhortation to present-day life?
Just a minute. It says our own resurrection. How can we have our own resurrection? I mean, is that past or future?
I'm not being nice because God's going to raise me. I'm not being nice because God's going to save me. I'm being nice because God gives me that gift.
Our own our own bodily resurrections that we know as a certainty is a vindication of Christ. And that fact determines our present course.
Okay. Thank you.
So, we don't deny the bodily resurrection, or do we?
I don't think we do. We believe in it. That we'll have
well, a resurrection. We say we believe in it, but does it affect how we live?
Well, the sex is horrible. Appetite is horrible. Dressing to look attractive is horrible. We put the body down a lot.
But does that have any...
Well, Western society puts the body down like that.
No, I don't have any answers for these. These are just questions that came off my head as I was thinking about. The text is ancient. It's really in what Paul's life and the Corinthian believers' lives. What relevance does it have for us? So we aren't in physical danger, daily physical danger, at least here in the U.S. for the most part. So, how does this text matter? We don't face daily the very real prospects of death. Should we be facing the prospects of death?
I got State Farm insurance to cover me.
No, you don't. You don't have life insurance.
We don't battle beasts on a regular basis.
I don't have to worry, I guess.
You said beasts was problems. We battle problems every day.
Are we living lives of futility?
So do you feel fulfilled, or do you just feel like life is futile?
Well, that one right there is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
We create artificial substance that may or may not be necessary, and that gives a lot of people guilt complexes. What's wrong with just living? Well, I didn't go on 3 mission trips last year. I didn't go and help those people down there. I didn't do this and I didn't do that. I just lived in my house and I kept my garden and I was nice to my neighbors. Is that a life of futility? And put myself down because my neighbor over there went around the world 6 times.
Are you content, or are you always like making stabs at the government?
I never make stabs at the government.
Are you content and you know when government does certain things that they have they have assumed that power to do that? And you live in this country.
A life of futility. What's wrong with just living?
You asking you, not you him.
I think that is a completely different thing for every person, apparently. Living for me.
I think if you're living for other people and doing things with other people, if it's just for yourself, it's more futile.
If that comes from the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die.
So, if you believe in that Christ has done the work of preparing for us again, then, and we believe we can die and live again, that's a hope. Anybody can live again. It's hope for everybody, not just me. Hope for the human race. Hope for the collective community.
Another way of looking at it is, are you living in hope? Or are you just going through the motions of life? Maybe very good things. A person can go on a mission trip with no hope.
I think that's why people with strong posts in their faith have strong hope. Let's take the Mormon Church. Those people have very strong posts in their faith. And so they have just supreme hope that they know will come to fruition.
So that's
life doesn't feel futile to them.
It's not futile. So therefore, if it doesn't feel futile, it isn't.
Yeah.
A person can have a life that's totally fulfilling in whatever way suits them and not believe in or ever participate in being resurrected and go to heaven. There are people who live their lives with no hope in the way we see hope, and yet they live
upright lives,
good lives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you have to believe that Jesus is going to come and resurrect us and take us to heaven in order for that to happen to you? Is the fact that that's a fact, and that we believe that's a fact, is that why it's going to happen, or is it going to happen even if you don't believe it?
Yeah, we need to back up to one of the earlier sections in this essay. Paul never addresses those outside Christians, Christianity. Paul is talking specifically about Christianity.
Right, he is, yes.
That if a person chooses to live the Christian life, then one must believe in the bodily resurrection. Otherwise, the Christian life is meaningless.
Right, that's true.
So when he said, when you said, are we living lives of futility, are you saying, are we living lives of futile hope? I don't think so.
No. If you don't believe that the body and the soul are connected, then you just kind of have this empty thing, because the body and the soul are one. You can't despise the body and say it's all bad and the soul's all good, because you're going to be doing things that have nothing to do with what Christ wanted for you.
So a Christian who truly, genuinely believes in the goodness of the body and the future, goodness of the body in the present and the future resurrection of the body, means that they will take care of not only their bodies, but of the body. It would not be, I don't evangelize just as fire insurance to get people out of hell. Evangelism is more than just saying the prayer, the sinner's prayer. Evangelism is about meeting people's physical needs,
caring for people,
their emotional needs in the present time, you know, there's all of their needs. So I guess the question is, is your Christian life, the things that you do as a Christian, why are you doing them? Is it so that you can someday get to heaven?
Well,
or because you see the value of the physical world today? Because part of this whole resurrection thing is that, yes, it's all those in Christ will be resurrected, but Paul doesn't speak about what happens to all the other people or the world itself, but in other letters, Paul writes that all creation is waiting to be restored to its original state.
And some of us believe, some of us, our lives, what we do is based on the Christians. And that's why we do things, because of the resurrection. And other people do it for some other reason.
Well, when I'm in church, I philosophize. But the rest of the week, if I am walking down the street and someone drops something and I pick it up for them, it's because who I am, not because I'm a Christian or I'm doing a Christian thing. Or it's not, I don't even think about it. It's who I am. And I think that...
But who you are as a Christian.
Well, I don't think I could be a Christian without that hope as actually happening, being there. If it didn't happen, that characteristic could not exist. And that gives me hope. But I think the word futility is the one that I think God created us to live lives of fulfillment. And we try to define fulfillment beyond just live your life. That's what God gave you. Enjoy it and live who you are. Rejoice in who you are.
A couple more here. So when the discussions about topics that don't conform to Christian orthodoxy deviate into drunkenness? And related, what are the inviolable, non-negotiable foundations of Christianity?
Well, obviously, the resurrection is a fact.
The bodily resurrection.
Bodily resurrection is a fact, if you're a Christian.
Well, this essay began with Paul giving the concise kernel of the Christian gospel, which was Jesus died, was buried, resurrected, and the resurrection was witnessed by hundreds. And without the resurrection, all the other things wouldn't have any meaning. But that is kind of like the core of what the Christian gospel is.
Drunkenness is, the essence of drunkenness is basically an absence of reasoning and discretion. So when your discussion refuses to acknowledge those elements, then that's when it goes into drunkenness.
Discussions about topics that don't conform to Christian orthodoxy. So we're going to talk about something that is contrary to historic Christian orthodoxy.
Who defines orthodoxy?
When does that discussion get into stupidity?
That gets back to what Paul said, bad company ruins good morals. Now, so the Corinthians, some of them were preoccupied with the not having a resurrection. And that was infecting and affecting the entire church.
I'm going to play on a sensitive one, see if I can understand what you're saying here. Last weekend, we were talking about the pros and cons of different types of coffee. That is not historic Adventist orthodoxy. Did that discussion go into drunkenness? It definitely was stretching some people's minds. When would that discussion get into stupidity?
When you start putting alcoholic beverages in your coffee.
I didn't say that.
No, alcohol is not anti-biblical.
No, but it causes drunkenness. It can.
Excess of anything will cause drunkenness.
Well, stupidity, yeah, excess of
Yeah. I've walked behind people on the dock at Point Baker, and I'm wondering if they're going to fall in the drink.
More point of protection, but yeah. Drunkenness, and that's the Orthodox Christianity, is we throw the baby out with the wash oh so often. There's nothing wrong with... I am starting to learn there's nothing wrong with coffee in a balance. There's nothing wrong with tea in a balance. There's nothing wrong with meat in a balance. There's nothing wrong with alcohol in a balance.
Right.
I haven't gone that far with tobacco yet.
Well.
But.
I think if it didn't have the smoke in the lungs, it really calms
you. Yeah, but in a different culture where, you know, the peace pipe, smoking.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's different type of products, isn't it? Is there smoked products that are not detrimental to the health?
Well, peyote.
Is it detrimental to the health?
It's a hallucinogenic.
But is it detrimental to the health?
Probably.
Well, inhaling any kind of air into your lungs is damaging to
your health at some point in time.
Sitting around a campfire all the time would be detrimental to
you. You can smoke a lot more pot than you can carcinogen cigarettes now because of the chemicals in which they're produced by. But you could do the same with regular tobacco, too. You could smoke tobacco grown in your backyard probably a heck of a lot longer with less effect than you could the tobacco that's in a regular cigarette.
Right.
But any ceremonial smoke inhalation at some point in time is going to cause an ill effect toward your lung. But whether it's impossible or wrong to do religiously, I would say probably not. I mean, if it's a ceremonial thing that people do, like sitting down to have a cigar at the end of some, you know, ridiculously lavish meal, that's probably not going to be a problem as long as it's a ceremonial gesture of like this is the best way.
The lavishness of the meal might be more.
Culturally, I have a problem with that, but philosophically, what you're saying is the fact that we live is detrimental to our lives.
Yeah, pretty much. Being born is a guarantee that you will die.
That's true.
They claim that every ounce of alcohol kills a brain cell.
Well, that's not true, but
every ounce of tobacco smoke has an effect.
Well,
if there there's balance. I'm starting to accept that there probably is balance to alcohol. I choose to not to do it, but I feel like there probably is a balance for some people. Is there a balance for tobacco for some people?
I think the thing with tobacco, the way I see it nowadays. Currently, the main thing about tobacco is exposing other people to it. If you want to do something to your body, have at it. It's your choice. But it's most of the laws concerning tobacco now, in Oregon, it's like just, it's totally, I mean, really strict. You don't smoke where other people have to breathe your smoke because that smoke is going to damage someone else. And so that's where the tobacco thing is nowadays.
Chewing.
Well, chewing, and there's no... You don't hear big things about chewing tobacco. People chew tobacco all the time, but they're not hurting anybody else, and that's why it's not a big deal, I think.
God lumped them all into one when he said gluttony.
That's food, too. That's food and everything.
What was Paul's kind of guiding principle for ethics and mission earlier in this letter? Think of others.
Right.
Think of how your actions will affect others.
Drinking a glass of wine isn't going to affect anybody unless you get drunk and go kill them, drive a car and kill them. That's others. Drinking it yourself, that's your business. It's your business. It's your business if you smoke a cigarette. But it's not when you're doing it to someone else.
So what? How did you tie this into F here?
F? So,
drunkenness.
Well, Paul was comparing, this idea of denying the resurrection as drunkenness. It was somehow an appealing form of doctrine that was infiltrating. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, it was very appealing to the Corinthian church.
Wonder why?
Because part of it has to do with kind of this the Greek body spirit dualism. You know, that's the idea. The body is evil was permeated the culture.
Oh right.
And it allowed them to just go ahead and be evil and wicked because of the belief that the spirit is a separate thing.
And the body's doing the wicked stuff.
Yeah.
And it could also be appealing to those who were tending towards asceticism, you know, where beat my body or I deny myself and I am better than you.
Well, if I change your word drunkenness to stupidity, any time I answer somebody to say that my doctrine is black and white and that's the way it is, I have turned off any ability to think, mm-hmm. any ability to discuss anything, and that's stupidity.
Mm-hmm. My mind is set. Don't confuse me with the facts.
Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe that's what we could say there, is if we use our Christian orthodoxy to turn our brains off, we're stupid.
I don't have any right answers for these. These are just mm-hmm. things to throw out to talk about. Because the center of this essay, you know, what we're discussing this week is how Paul wanted to apply the theology of the resurrection to the actual ethics in the church. You know, theology is easy to talk about.
Yes. But is it relevant? Whatever you're talking about, is it relevant?
Theology isn't important if it's not relevant to actual life.
Right.
So the ethics behind the resurrection is what Paul is trying to explain.
To the Corinthians.
Yeah.
Have you explained any of that yet?
the Corinthians thought they could do anything.
No, I understand all that. They believe that it would be basic. But what is it, did Paul outline his ethics then? Or have you not gotten to that part?
What you do matters.
Yeah, what you do matters. In fact, if there is no resurrection, then what you do doesn't matter at all.
Relevant at all.
Okay.
Does this support God's creation was perfect and you created your body?
In defense of the doctrination world of this and that, basically what they were trying to achieve was some form of a base rule line to conduct yourself so that you can stay within the what you do matters guidelines. So it all got obscured, but basically you can consume and drink alcohol, you can eat with friends in different places, you can have conversations with people about things that may not be Christian. You can talk to countries and places of origin that have no idea that this exists. But the drunkenness part is when you take your opinion to those places and abolish their livelihoods, lifestyles, and every other form of the person that they are by
missionaries do
over-consuming them with your belief in any way, shape, or form. And what Paul is saying is that the Corinthian church has done exactly that to the Christian church by deciding that their way, what they want to institutionalize as their doctrine, has become a drunken display of their decision of power or their way of thinking. And that's what Paul's getting at. Is that what you guys discussed? Kind of in a
partially what I'm saying, and I think you said part of it too, is I can choose not to smoke, I can choose not to eat certain meats, I can choose not to drink and all this stuff. but I can't really, I shouldn't be using Christian orthodoxy as my justification. I can choose it, but if I just stand behind.
So with the physical resurrection, does that mean that that's why some Orthodox would say that they don't want to drink or smoke or do these things, that the body has to be as pure as the spirit?
Oh, yeah, we've heard that.
It rises again.
We've heard that.
That's another side of the coin.
But what Paul's getting at is he's trying to explain that it doesn't matter, body or spirit, you want both to come through.
Yeah, in this next part of the essay, Paul is going to answer the question, or at least attempt to answer the question, so what kind of body is the resurrection body?
That's what I'm saying. Like, so if you have this clean spirit, clean body attitude, well, then you're really trying to portray both of them in the same way.
Yeah. So is it the same body, or is it a different body? And Paul is going to go on it is still a physical body, but it is a different body.
I would hope so. I mean, even the most wonderful, greatest body or the most worst, debilitated body are going to be irrelevant to the new body.
But at the same time, he talked about one of the earlier parts of 1 Corinthians, that what you do in your present body does matter.
Is it about a disciplined attitude toward your body and your spirit, then? Because, see, the Corinthians are kind of just basically trying to throw over their shoulder the body part so that they can abuse it in a way that they see fit. Now,
it's not that they can abuse it, it's just that if the body is irrelevant, then
it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying.
They had a whole theology
built on it. So that means that
your
sloth, your whatever, is going to not necessarily matter anymore, which will interpret your spiritual way of life also.
Right.
Because if you have these aspects physically, you can tend to take those habitual habits toward your spiritual effect also.
Okay, there's two sides of this coin that you probably didn't grow up in, but we grew up in. One is, we have been taught that the body, we haven't been taught. We've been told there's some people out there that don't, they think that their spiritual is perfect, but their body doesn't matter. The other side of that coin is, God saved me when I was baptized. Now it's my responsibility to make a perfect body as a kernel of a corn is perfect as it grows, so that by the time I die, I have perfected myself as much as possible. That's the other extreme. And my argument is, God created me perfect and I should live and not be worried about making myself perfect, because that's, to me, saving myself and getting my own bootstraps.
Yeah.
That's
God
the other
created
side
me
of
perfect
point.
And getting you back to that perfection is his job.
It's his job, and I trust him. The reason I don't smoke isn't trying to make my body perfect.
She don't want to die of lung cancer, that's all.
Okay, but what I was asking is, so was Paul going toward a certain objective of keeping people's disciplines together in a way? Like, is there something to that?
Paul, throughout this essay, throughout this letter, underlying it is that what you do affects everyone else.
Right.
Your actions, your actions are never
your own
in isolation.
See, that's why I keep going to this, and the reason why I do is because it's so physically we consider our own body, our own world, our little island, to say, and that what we do to it really doesn't affect anybody. But right now, there's an entire country affected by people's health and well-being. So there, right there, is Paul trying to bring people to the ideology that yes, the body as a part of your spiritual resurrection is important through the disciplines that you have as a spiritual person. You put those toward your body, because in your community together, you need healthy people. You need a certain amount of health and well-being to the physical person also, or you're going to lose that ability to do the spiritual part also. And I'm just wondering if that's part of what he was saying there, because it really is important. I mean, if you don't take care of yourself, but you expect to be taken care of or whatever, then you are literally affecting countless
people
around you.
We have a responsibility I have a responsibility to myself and my community, and how I treat my physical body is an effect on the community.
And if everyone fought that way and lived that way, then community would be
better.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Well, but your health care bills would go down. But not only that, also your morality duality or whatever would start to come closer together too. You wouldn't have such big gaps in people's understanding of sex, of partnership, and other things like that too, because the morality of the body would, you know, you would be able to bring that closer together, because people wouldn't be feeling like, oh, now that I'm saved, I can do all the debauchery that I care to do because the body's dead.
That's the one extreme.
Right. So what I'm saying is that you know, what I'm asking is it makes sense, in a sense of control, but not really control, but like trying to just get people to understand that the body's important, because if you just throw it away, your actions, because you throw it away here, are going to completely go against the spiritual aspect of what you're trying to do. So it's hard to say that it's God's job to make you perfect. It's not really God's job to make you perfect, but it is your job in a way to try to obtain His idea of what He wants for you.
Yeah.
Slightly. I mean, you know, it's not that a paraplegic should spend his days out trying to walk again so that he's perfect for God, but that within his own ability and power to be healthy spiritually and physically.
Christ is the church. And the church is composed of individual human beings. But they have to work together. So
they have to interface.
Yeah, if we as physical beings living in an actual period of time weren't important, God could have found some other way.
Yeah. I guess to me it still comes back to why.
Why does God need people?
You know, why do you do what you do? I do it because I enjoy doing it.
That's what you want to do.
And I hate it when I go to potlucks and they drink imitation wine just to be silly. You know, if you want to drink wine, drink
honey,
it. It's fine.
Honey, you don't have to put it in your thing, your disdain of alcohol.
Let me put it another way. People should do what they want to do because they want to do
it. Well, they probably are. They're probably drinking imitation wine because that's what they want to do.
That's
fine.
And it's good they're drinking imitation wine if they
want the
they
wine
can't
they
handle
alcohol.
That's fine, too.
So it's fine. Don't let it get you down.
This is really important. I like what Paul's doing here. It's very important for...
They have imitation wine on sale at Hammer's.
The
finger
or the impressed location. I didn't live and grow up in an impressionable world. I didn't have a doctrine behind me telling me what I should or shouldn't do. And I kind of like what Paul's doing and understand why he would be doing it, because when you don't have the two together, when you're just thinking that spiritually you're okay, you can go through your life and actually kind of like let yourself go a little bit as you get older, start having heart attacks, eating wrong, things like this, that you don't really, you're not a bad person. You're not mad at anybody. You go to church every week. You think you love everybody there, but what you're forgetting is that the sorrow that those people might endure because you weren't exactly thinking about your health, because it's not part of the religious process that you're taking into consideration, then that's going to cause an effect. And so it's kind of important to talk about the body and to understand the body and the resurrection of a physical being, because that gives you, until this day, I never really thought about my religious practice. Well, I mean, I did. I understood a little bit, but your religious practice to maintain a certain level of doing what you want, but also not going excessively past that, is important. It's very important. And as a church group,
what you do will affect me.
Right. And as a church group, you need to understand that, because those moral complications through your physical actions are going to impress or, you know, impact the people around you. It's very important for people that believe that, oh man, I love God and God's great and everything's okay. Now, there's physical debilitation, like, you know, you physically and genetically are going to be heavier set than somebody else. That doesn't mean that you have to spend every day of your life running so that you can be physically fit to the standard that you need to be. But
someone else may be, yeah.
But to understand it, to at least take it into consideration in your spiritual life, that there is a certain standard that you should try to physically keep your well-being of your spiritual and physical body at, so that the course of the church and the community can work, function smoothly or easier, and the work of Christ can be done. That's profound to me, because I hadn't thought about it that way, but that puts into perspective everything that people talk about healthcare, about moral obligation as far as relationship or violence and physical abuse. Things like that are something that is never addressed in that way. And that's something that people should think about more often when they talk about that, is that if what you hear is cleanliness, is godliness, or you need to be... And what it does is it breaks down, like you're saying, is that these churches, suddenly you can't drink coffee, you have to eat vegetables, you're wrong if you do this. That's what...
The wrong perspective.
Exactly. They need to bring it back into the... It's okay, you can do these things, but you have to spiritually abide by... Your physical body has to abide by the spiritual regulations that you hold your spirit.
Dolores' brother stopped smoking, not because it was unhealthy to him, but because he wanted to see his child grow up.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say, Mark?
It comes down to... Think, you know, think of others before yourself. Mm-hmm.